Today, latest GDP shows burnout economy in action. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance and Little Hits. Well, let's post covering finance and property news. Today, we've got the latest data from the ABS on the Australian economy via the backward-looking data on GDP to September 2025. As you know, I think GDP is a bad measure of anything useful because it simply measures activity in the economy wherever it comes from, yet economists, politicians and bankers seem fixated on looking in the rearview mirror. Nevertheless, the ABS reported the Australian gross domestic product rose 0.4% in the September quarter and 2.1% compared to a year ago, that's seasonally adjusted. That was below economists' forecast of 0.7% and highlights the real problem we have in Australia, as details show domestic demand held up and labour costs stayed elevated. In a further sign that the economy was expanding faster than previously thought, the ABS also revised up its economic growth estimate for the June quarter from 1.8 to 2% in annual terms, but the results were below the RBA's expectations. They'd penciled in around a 0.55% quarterly growth in the November statement of monetary policy, as the RBA continues to operate, well, in a fog, frankly, perpetually whiplash between growth and inflation. The economy continues upward momentum in the December quarter, growing at the fastest annual rate in more than 2 years on the back of the investment boom in data centres and artificial intelligence, as well as government spending. But while Australia has long been known for its prosperous economy, with many calling it the lucky country, that luck may be starting to change. While the overall economy is not in recession, frankly, many people are. Spin Jim Chalmers was quick to push the story based on stronger household spending growth, up 0.5% on the quarter, driven by a 1% rise, though, in essential spending on insurance, rent and food as consumers cut back on non-essential purchases.
The really encouraging part of these numbers is to see that the growth in the private sector is gathering pace, and that's powered by the strongest growth in private investment in almost 5 years. The biggest story in these national accounts is the very strong growth in business investment and investment in housing as well. This is a positive and promising result. It speaks directly to the progress that we've made together in our economy. It's especially heartening to see the way that the private sector is gathering pace when you see the business investment numbers and also when you see the progress we've made in this quarter and through the year in housing as well.
And also, it was driven by stronger private investment, including $2.8 billion worth of investments in data centres in just 3 months. That's double the previous period. And that's powering, of course, the artificial intelligence boom, which has indeed propelled business investment growth to its fastest pace in more than 4 years, despite, though, public spending still comprising more than 28% of the story, and even more, depending on how you count the numbers. Actually, the uptick in government spending and investment contributed 0.3 percentage points to quarterly growth, and investment by governments grew by 3%, driven by renewable energy and transport projects. And overall, sure, it was the highest annual growth rate in 2 years, but it's still well below the 2.9% average growth rate that was achieved in the two decades before the pandemic. And in truth, in per capita terms, GDP fell very slightly, down 0.01%. It's actually fallen for 10 out of the past 13 quarters, albeit the last two quarterly falls were very, very small. And that was in line with population growth, actually, but it remains 0.4% higher than a year ago. And we also saw confirmation in these numbers what we expected to see. There was a rebound in population growth, guess what? Thanks to higher migration. Unit labour costs, that's a gauge of domestically generated inflation, rose 4.9% from a year earlier, which suggests that wages are rising too quickly to be consistent with the RBA's 2 to 3% inflation target rate. estimate of rooftop solar electricity generation and consumption were included in the Australian National Accounts for the first time. Now, this actually had a minimal impact on the key aggregates such as GDP, but is notable for its components. Household solar accounted for about 8% of total electricity production in 2024-25. Rooftop solar electricity production in 2024-25 has grown to be more than 20 times higher than it was in 2010-11. And households consume about half of rooftop solar electricity they generate and send the remainder to the grid. And the ABS added additional analysis included in the release shows that rooftop solar electricity saved households about $3 billion in 2024-2025. Now, all up, productivity growth lifted in the September quarter to 0.8%. That's near pre-pandemic levels, but is still short of Treasury's 1.2% medium-term productivity growth assumption. Chris Richardson managed to sum up the story rather well, writing on X that 2.1% growth over the past year was still enough to push growth back close to its potential. Our problem, he said, though production has lifted 2.1%, demand rose 2.6%. Worse still, that 2.6 was probably really 2.8% because the ABS just announced a guess at the speed of the rise in illegal tobacco. We'll come back to that shortly. So although our growth rate is disappointing, it is probably in line with what we're set to achieve over the longer term. And our spending is travelling faster still, meaning that our dollar desires are pressing on the accelerator, even though the clapped-out engine of the Australian economy is doing the best it can. Yep, Burnett economics. That gap, too much money chasing too little stuff, is part of why price pressures are lingering. Or to put it differently, the Australian public hasn't yet understood the many implications of our poor productivity performance, including slow income growth per person and a more inflation-prone economy. And just on the tobacco issue, as Richardson said elsewhere, the ABS thinks that the illegal tobacco market in the nation grew by more than $10 billion in the past 2 years, with an ongoing but rising shortfall of close to $12 billion at annualized rates. That points to worsening health outcomes. We tried to make smoking more expensive, but actually made it cheaper. It's consistent with the collapse of the tax take. If everyone were paying the tax, we'd be raising an extra $15 billion a year. It's an impressive large gift to organise crime, now the most subsidised industry in the nation, he said, and is even a larger kick in the teeth for those smokers and businesses who have stayed in the legal market. The GBDP report adds to an ongoing debate about the restrictiveness of Australian monetary policy and whether the economy is running beyond its speed limit. A key question for policymakers is also how much further can they lower borrowing costs, if at all, in an environment of a still tight labour market and poor productivity growth. Weak productivity means any pickup in demand risks spilling straight into prices. In the third quarter, output per hour worked was just 0.2% higher than 3 months earlier, while market sector productivity was absolutely flat. Wednesday's data also showed that the household savings ratio climbed to 6.4% from 6% 3 months ago. Households shifted away from discretionary spending down 0.2% while boosting essential outlays up 1%. And within that component, household spending advanced 0.5%, adding 0.3 percentage points to GDP growth, while government spending rose 0.8%, adding 0.2 percentage points, and changes in inventory subtracted 0.5 points, and net trade detracted 0.1 percentage points from GDP growth. While markets initially read the report as disappointing, sending the currency and bond yields lower in response to traders trimming bets on an interest rate hike next year, they actually reversed later. And overnight index swaps are now applying around a 95% chance that the next move from the central bank will be higher in 2026. That continued strength in unit labour costs suggests that the bank really has no scope at all to cut rates, and it needs to stay the course, and it needs to stay on the sidelines or maybe even put rates up. Information on inflation was generally less pleasing, said Andrew Tyhurst, a senior Australia rates strategist at Nomura Holdings in Sydney. There is little within this report that will give the RBA comfort. We anticipate a further hawkish shift in tone at its policy meeting next week. The RBA, of course, will hold its final policy meeting of the year on December 8th and 9th, when rates are widely expected to stay unchanged at 3.6% after three cuts this year. The bank expects the economy to grow around its potential rate of 2% in 2026, supported by lower borrowing costs, steady household incomes, and still strong population growth. Now, in a quirk of timing, RBA Governor Michelle Bullock appeared before Senate estimates earlier on Wednesday. Inflation is not yet sustainably back within the Reserve Bank of Australia's target band, with the unemployment rate of 4.3%. Bullock said the current employment rate of 4.3% was historically pretty low and a very good outcome. And she said if inflationary pressures were more permanent, it would have implications for the future path of monetary policy as the markets increase its confidence in interest rate hikes next year. If consumer price gains prove more persistent, and we'll get more information on this in the next couple of months, then that's suggesting to us that the demand pressures are persisting, and that might have implications for the future path of monetary policy. Projections still see inflation coming back down, Bullock said, but obviously we're alert to the possibility that there might be inflation pressures building, and the board would have to respond accordingly. And the governor said it remains hard to judge whether the economy is running above potential, though her assessment is that the output gap has closed, meaning any upside surprise in demand would quickly translate into price pressures. If we are already at balance and demand increases much more sharply than we'd expect, then that would put a bit of upward pressure on inflation, she said. Data in recent days has pointed to underlying strengths in the economy, with home prices extending gains in November, business investment coming on stronger than expected for the 3 months ended September, and household consumption generally proving somewhat resilient. Now that's prompted some economists, including those at Commonwealth Bank and Australia Bank, to flag the risk of a rate hike in 2026. That is the whole purpose of the board, to try and bring it back sustainably. Have we done it yet? No, we haven't done it yet, so we need to keep working on it, she said. Annual headline inflation in October increased to 3.8%. That was above the RBA's target band of 2-3% and exceeded the forecast of the central bank, which had expected to reach 3.3% by the end of the year. Bullock said the private sector was beginning to take over from the public sector as the driver of economic growth. The public sector drove almost 70% of real GDP growth between the middle of 2022 and 2024, and figures on Tuesday indicated public demand grew 1.2% in the December quarter. In times when private demand is not doing very well, often what happens is that public demand comes in to fill the gap, Bullock said. If the private sector is not contributing much in a cyclical sense, say it's in recession, then you would expect the public sector to be accounting for more of the growth. And she said that as the private sector continues to build, the role of the public sector in driving growth would decline. And Bullock said it was not yet clear whether the economy was running above capacity, but she added that even if supply and demand were in balance, there were still upside risks to inflation if growth picks up. Now, it's easy to dismiss the Reserve Bank of Australia's regular appearance before Senate as just political pantomiming, particularly because, well, frankly, they are. But under all of this, if you look carefully, this did underscore the central bank's big problem. It does not have a firm grip on whether interest rates are restrictive, and that won't change in a hurry. Bullock admitted as much herself, conceding the RBA is simultaneously pleased with the state of the jobs market, surprised by last month's hot inflation, and comforted that inflation expectations remain anchored. But the result of these cross currents means it's uncertain whether the economy was operating above potential. And if we're in balance, there are upside risks to inflation if the economy grows a bit quickly, if we're already at potential. So that's sort of the issue we're dealing with, she said. Costs are biting on businesses, and that they're able to pass them on doesn't necessarily mean that we're operating beyond potential, but it does mean that demand is recovering enough to allow businesses to pass on costs. In other words, it's all as clear as mud. Little wonder that the market has priced in the RBA sitting on its hands in the next few months for hiking rates sometime in 2026. Money markets suggest a 95% chance of a hike by next December. Now, to be fair to Bullock and her team, this is actually a global challenge for central bankers. As Macquarie strategist Victor Schiffs said, the confusing picture implies that central banks are in the dark and have no choice but to remain backward-looking or data-dependent. There are just far too many moving parts to be confident of one's understanding of where real neutral rates are and whether they are rising or falling. The problem, Schiffs says, is what he calls the four horsemen of the apocalypse, all of which were on display during Bullock's estimates appearance, as Bullock's told senators on more than one occasion. And for the umpteenth time in these hearings, the RBA is not responsible for house prices, even if, as a mother and a grandmother, she can understand why it's a hot topic of questions.
Our mandate, Senator, is inflation and unemployment. The housing market is a very important social issue, and people's ability to purchase houses is very important. Housing prices is not a mandate or a goal of the Reserve Bank. Certainly the housing market is a way through which monetary policy works, and that's the lens through which we look at it. But whether or not potential taxation changes to address housing issues are not the bailiwick of the Reserve Bank.
The fact that the RBA isn't mandated to manage house prices, indeed no one is, which is arguably part of the problem, might give Bullock a way to deflect these questions. But housing affordability is central to two of Schiff's four horsemen: polarisation and policy uncertainty. Asset price inflation, including the 47% jump in the median national house price over the past 5 years, breeds inequality, which leads to polarisation, which leads to poor policy, and that is something that the RBA does have to deal with. Naturally, there are plenty of questions about domestic policy choices, such as the Albanese government's decision to boost housing demand through its first home buyer deposit scheme. But there are international questions too, including a long and largely pointless line of inquiry on whether the potential unwinding of the Japanese carry trade has ramifications for Australia. Which brings us to another key line of questioning from Wednesday about China. Here Bullock was unequivocal. The RBA is watching and is worried. What's happening in China is very important to us, she said.
Just thinking about China, because China is such an important part of our trade relationships. It's 30% of our exports. So what happens in China is very important to us, and what we observe there is that the real estate market in China is still very much in the doldrums, that at the moment they're managing to offset that with growth in other areas, but there's still a risk to growth in China. I think that's something that's sort of at the top of our mind as well.
China is one of Schiff's horsemen too. Whatever China does will have significant impact on global growth, inflation, rates and geopolitics, he says. While questions remain about the resilience of Chinese exports, its willingness to push back on Donald Trump's trade policies, and the degree to which China can improve competitiveness across some particularly bloated sectors, he says, the central problem is the defining characteristic of a liquidity trap. Neither households nor corporates desire to borrow and invest, preferring to save and repay debt. In large part, this is due to past and current misallocation of capital, especially real estate, where both investment and prices continue to fall. When China might start the process of rebalancing its economy, what impact this might have on its world-leading economic growth rates and how this filters through to iron ore prices are all issues that Bullock and the team will be thinking particularly hard about. China's rapidly growing debt means this moment of rebalancing will eventually come, but questions over its growth will only add to the Australian economic puzzle. And Schiff's final horseman, artificial intelligence, only got a cursory mention on Wednesday, when RBA Assistant Governor Christopher Kent called out stretched valuations in equity markets.
Well, one thing that I think is on the minds of many central bankers around the world is the valuation of asset prices. quite elevated, I think, is how many would describe equity prices, and credit spreads are quite low. So markets have a relatively optimistic view of the future, whether it's through the productivity benefits that will come from AI or just generally benign conditions. So that could change for any number of different reasons. Now, that may, if asset prices were to fall, that may just reflect some other shock that's affecting the economy. Whether it's an amplifier of such a shock is a big question. One thing that is giving people some comfort is, at least in equity markets, there's not a lot of leverage behind those positions that people have. So those can unwind without necessarily causing much damage to the economy. But there might be hidden pockets of leverage here and there. And one area people are focused on is private credit markets. Not so much in Australia because it's not such an important part of our financial system, but it has become increasingly important offshore, particularly in the US.
Hopefully Kent's right, but that's not the big question about AI that should consume central banks, Shibitz argues. The bigger issue is how the combination of AI and a hyper-financialized economy change the role and functioning of both capital and labor that is likely to intensify in the years to come. Or, to put it more simply, will the labour market gains that the RBA is so justifiably proud of eventually be upended by a wave of job losses caused by AI? Interestingly, the GDP number did give a hint of this. That doubling of investment in data centres during the quarter to $2.8 billion lit a fire under business investment in national accounts. Clearly, this concern won't dominate the RBA's thinking in the near term, but that's exactly the point. These four horsemen are over on the horizon for central banks: AI, polarization, policy uncertainty, and China, but they won't disappear anytime soon. So all up, the Australian share market was up just a few points, 0.2%, to 8,592.5 at the closing bell, after initially spiking as much as 0.5% on news the economy had expanded at just 0.4% in 3 months through September, which was well below the market consensus, and 8 out of 11 sectors were in the green. So standing back, Tarek Brooker's call about the burnout economy that he made several years ago now is proving to be spot on. We are in a desperate trap with potentially higher interest rates ahead, low productivity, and significant pressure on households. In fact, Tarek and I will be talking about this on our Friday show, which we'll be recording as normal this week. But the bottom line is, the Australian economy is in the doldrums, despite what politicians may say. Many households are under huge recessionary pressures. And whilst there are some bright spots in some parts of the markets, well, our regulators and central banks are really in a bit of a fog. So, yes, we are in a difficult bind at the moment, and there's no easy exit. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.